This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. The first season of the Slow Burn podcast, produced by the online magazine Slate, told an 8-part true story of political dirty tricks, scandal, and a president who would seemingly say anything to cover his tracks and stay in office. But if you thought it was a current events podcast, you'd be mistaken. The events Slow Burn describes happened 45 years ago. It was the Watergate scandal that brought down President Richard Nixon.
What happens when the president uses the machinery of the government to protect himself against an outside threat? And what does it feel like when you are that threat and the most powerful person in the country shuts you down? This is Slow Burn, a podcast about Watergate. I'm your host, Leon Nafok.
A lot of hard words were traded in Washington.
Journalist Leon Nafok was the reporter behind Slow Burn, and he sought to relate some of the many stories of Watergate that have been all but lost over time and portray what it was like to experience that political scandal in real time. I spoke with Leon Nafok in front of a live audience at UW Milwaukee last week, and we'll hear some of that conversation on today's show. Leon Nafok, welcome to Milwaukee. So I'm wondering, as the reporter on this series, whether you came out of it with the same feeling that I did as a listener, the somewhat odd feeling that I wish the crisis had gone on longer.
Well, we did 8 episodes, and towards the end, I felt like we were rushing through a lot of good stuff, and I almost wish that we could have done 12 or something, so that we could have slowed down a little bit and chewed on it a little bit longer. Because it did feel like we were sort of tumbling down a hill as the impeachment inquiry heated up, and we could have spent a little more time on it, I think.
It's like that phenomenon in history class where you spend all this time in the Civil War and Reconstruction, and then like the last two classes you do the entire 20th century.
That's right. Well, when I started working on this, I rewatched all the President's Men just to like remind myself of what it was I already vaguely knew about Watergate and what other people might be expected to know. And I was astonished to realize that the actual film covers the first like 5.5-6 months of the story. And then the entire, I think like another year and a half gets montaged through a bunch of newspaper headlines in the way that you just described.
Right. So how well-versed did you think you were on Watergate when you went into this process?
I did not think I was well-versed, but it didn't occur to me that there were as many sort of intriguing subplots and as many characters that I wasn't even remotely aware of. As it turned out, there are I kind of was skeptical initially when my editors wanted to undertake this project, because I felt like this is a pretty familiar story. People know there was a break-in at the DNC. People know that it was controversial, and people know that he was forced out of office because of it. How much more could there be to it? And so it was when I read the story of Martha Mitchell that my eyes were opened to all the really delightful details and sort of peripheral characters that I learned about over the course of my research.
Well, you just brought up an interesting point a minute ago. You went back and watched All the President's Men, and you make the point in the series a couple of times that not only is it the Woodward and Bernstein version of Watergate that really dominates the public consciousness 45 years later, but it's really the movie version of the Woodward and Bernstein story. What did you learn in doing this series about how some accounts get to be history of record while others get to be forgotten, more or less?
Yeah, it's a totally fascinating question. We did a live show in New York about 2 weeks ago, and that was actually the exact theme of the night. I don't really have a great answer. With All the President's Men, I mean, I think it probably helps that it was a great film. It helps that Robert Redford was in it. Bob Woodward was one of the guests at our event, and I asked him what it's been like to be sort of Mr. Watergate, to be responsible for like the dominant version of the story, when a lot of the chapters of the story have nothing to do with journalism. There's a chapter about the Senate, there's a chapter about the House, there's a chapter about the Special Prosecutor's Office. All of these different kind of institutions had to function in order for the story to go the way it did. And for the most part, those aren't really in the Woodward and Bernstein version because, you know, why should it be? I mean, they were telling their story, right? Their book is about their reporting process. But it's not just a story about journalism. And so I believe the best thing he said was, well, what has it been like? I've disappointed a lot of women, meaning doesn't look quite like Robert Redford, which took me a second on stage. It took me a second too long before I could laugh.
You, a few seconds ago, changed a verb tense from are to were when you were talking about the characters. But there is something significant to this story in that not all, but many of the people in the orbit of Watergate are still alive and are still, I don't know, happy to talk about that period?
Yeah, well, so you said still. I don't know if still is the right word or if it's the opposite, where they're like, eh, I'm like 85. I might as well talk about this now. we had people that we interviewed who were really, really eager to sort of relive this part of their lives because it was an extremely important part of who they became. And a lot of these people were amazingly like in their 20s and 30s when they were, you know, working for the Senate Investigative Committee, when they were working for the House when the impeachment probe was underway. The whole like staff of the special prosecutor's office were these kids in their late 20s, early 30s, fresh out of law school, who were hanging out together drinking when they weren't, you know, collecting evidence on Nixon's obstruction of justice.
You can almost imagine it being an Aaron Sorkin series.
You could imagine that. I wish someone more important than me could imagine it.
What were to you the biggest challenges in trying to tell this story in that sort of real-time fashion 4 decades after it happened?
So the hardest part, I think, was sort of finding the right individuals to tell each part of the story, right? So we, you know, our first move in kind of after we'd sort of done our preliminary research was to try to outline this story and try to divide it into chunks. We knew we wanted to do 8 episodes. I'm not really sure how we decided on 8, but we knew 8 was the number. And so, you know, the first challenge was to try to figure out where each one would start and where they would end. And then sort of try to find conceptual questions that each one could be focused on. So like episode 3 was about why it took so long for the American people to start caring about Watergate and to become interested in it and become concerned that the president had done all these things. Nixon won by a massive landslide in 1972, despite the fact that, you know, all those stories that we see being reported out in All the President's Men were already published. And even though Walter Cronkite had, you know, put on an unprecedented special on the news about all the connections between these burglars and the White House. And it was sort of triangulating between, like, we got to get from here to here in the timeline, and we got to find the right characters who will allow us to tell that part of the story and, like, allow us to explore these sort of thematic questions that we wanted each episode to be about.
Yeah, well, and the thing that really strikes me is that the number of, you know, kind of authors and historians that assist you in telling the story is pretty low. This is not a Ken Burns series.
Yeah, I think we tried to keep it pretty light on secondary sources. I think we have like probably between 1, 2, and 3 in each episode. The best use of, I think, secondary sources was in this series was when you had someone who was an expert on something very narrow. We had a historian who just knows everything about Wright Patman. She wrote a book about Wright Patman, and so it was just great to be able to have her sort of ransack her research, you know, for us, and then tell us everything she knows about it. You know, but we also interviewed someone, you know, people like Rick Perlstein, who has written extensively and broadly about Nixon and the conservative movement in general. And so I think we always wanted to use people who were there when we could, and then use historians to sort of give us the scaffolding of sort of like what is the significance of it, not so much narrate the stories, which we wanted to leave to the individuals who lived through them.
You bring up Wright Patman. You also make a really interesting comparison in the first episode of the show about Martha Mitchell. You compare her to Anthony Scaramucci, mm-hmm. Who was White House communications director for like 25 minutes last summer.
That's right.
But the point you make is that for every huge story, there are these people who are briefly important players, Wright Patman, Martha Mitchell, any number of people in the series, who are largely forgotten, except in maybe really difficult trivia competitions.
Right.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, otherwise we get the, you know, to be able to tell any history, we're hit with the information fire hose.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a necessary process, sort of. I'm reaching for the metaphor. What's the thing that you use to sifting? There you go. Thank you. You know, I think in 45 years, like, who are going to, and I've wondered this, like, who will be the characters in the drama that's currently unfolding that will be remembered? You know, it's funny you mentioned. So Anthony Scaramucci was my comparison point for Martha Mitchell, not because they were both, you know, got in trouble for talking to reporters, though it turned out they have that in common as well. But because they do both seem like sort of peripheral in the same way. But then more recently, a guy whose name I had to work very hard 10 seconds ago to remember, Sam Nunberg, who was like a friend of Trump's, possibly a lawyer of Trump's, I don't even remember, went on television, drunk, and said all kinds of things he wasn't supposed to say. And suddenly he was the Martha Mitchell of the current crisis. And I'll be really interested to see who are the sort of lasting figures, because I think this is the story that we're seeing now is like just seems almost exclusively populated by minor characters. Like there's one major character, and everybody else is sort of in his orbit.
It's kind of the way he likes it, though.
Exactly. No, I think it's quite by design.
One of the other things that occurred to me in listening to the full series that I had never really known before is that there were really actually, and maybe they were minor players, but there were a lot more women in the orbit of Watergate than we'd been led to believe. And maybe that's because that's the way history has often been told through the years. But, you know, it's not something that comes out in most stories of Watergate.
Yeah, it was something that we were happy to see happen when we noticed it in our writing and reporting. It wasn't something we like deliberately set out to do, but I do think it's sort of a natural result of trying to find unexplored angles and trying to find. I get self-conscious calling them characters because they're real people, but in our search for sort of underappreciated or under-remembered characters, it's not that surprising that more of them turn out to be women. But you know, it was a happy sort of byproduct of our broader mission to try to find fresh ways into this rather familiar story.
Now you had always worked in print before this project.
Yep.
Aside from this music video you were telling me about as we sat here. So sound would not necessarily have mattered, but in addition to the audio interviews you did for the series, talk about your impressions of some of the archival sound that you used to illustrate it.
Well, I've been thinking about this a little bit lately because I'm currently working on what will be season two of Slow Burn about the Clinton years, and I'm realizing as I'm kind of working with the archival footage that I can't expect it to be as transporting as the stuff that we used in this show, because it just sounds a lot more similar to what we are used to hearing. Like, TV from the 90s doesn't sound that different from TV in 2018. Like the intro music for like the evening news is a little more brassy and a little more dramatic maybe than it is now, but to the point where you can kind of date it. But the way that people talk, the way they sound, the way the recording sounds, you can't date it as precisely as when you hear John Chancellor speaking as an NBC anchor, both in terms of how the recording sounds and in terms of his, you know, accent's the wrong word, but just his dialect. And you could think of it in retrospect as like a crutch. I mean, it was so instantly transporting to hear some of this tape. Sorry.
Go back to John Chancellor for a second, because I know some people have kind of described him as the co-narrator in this series.
That's right.
What did having
yes.
John Chancellor's voice throughout the series mean for it?
Well, there's a reason that we used a lot of John Chancellor, which is not a sexy reason. And that reason is that we got a great licensing deal with NBC that allowed us to use him, and other networks were less generous, and so we used less of them. But at the same time, it was also, again, a happy kind of byproduct in that he did feel like a presence throughout, and it was cool to hear him sound a little bit different based on what was happening. So in most of the recordings that you hear in the season, rather in the show, he sounds calm, like he's just the kind of inveterate newsman who is steady and dispassionate. And then the tape of him reacting to the Saturday Night Massacre, he is shaken, and you can tell he's shaken. And it just sort of spoke to how wild that moment was. And I think if you heard just that out of context, you might not necessarily appreciate it. So I was happy to have him as my co-pilot.
Well, and you bring up the idea that dialect has kind of changed. And it's really, it hasn't been chronologically all that many years, but you listen to the politicians of the era talk, and their speaking style is completely different than what we are used to hearing from politicians today.
Yeah, I mean, especially Nixon, who, as we were discussing before the show, had such a distinctive way of speaking, and just a total wonder that he became president, given how strange he was and how socially clumsy and just awkward he was. You'd think to be the most powerful politician in the country, you have to have a little finesse.
There are clearly a lot of parallels people can draw between Watergate and the current state of presidential politics, but you never really belabor that in the course of this series. I mean, you bring it up at the beginning and at the end of the series explicitly, but were you trying consciously to give Watergate its own breathing room?
I would say we were obviously aware of the parallels that listeners were also aware of. But we didn't deliberately run towards them. We didn't deliberately seek them out. And I wasn't necessarily expecting them. Like, we obviously started doing this because of the current political situation and because we felt like there was a broad parallel in the sense that here was a period of time in American history when the country's political situation or the functioning of the government felt very precarious. And when a period of time when people were waking up in the morning and not knowing what was going to happen next. And they were reading about things in the newspaper that had never happened before. And what did that feel like? And did it feel similar to the way we feel now? And, you know, that's obviously a premise in which the idea of parallels is sort of embedded. But we did not expect the level of sort of the specificity of the parallels that we ended up finding. I mean, my favorite, and this is actually an example of one where I did kind of write towards it a little bit because I did. It was just sort of too good to leave on the cutting room floor. But so at a certain point, Nixon was being pressured to release more tapes. He'd released some tapes to the special prosecutor. He had to release more, or he was being asked to release more. And he, once again, tried to compromise by publishing. They did, in fact, publish official government, printed government printing office editions of this, thousands of pages of transcripts of Oval Office tapes that again had been edited, and he said they were edited. He said, you know, we've taken out national security stuff, we've taken out irrelevant stuff, but you know the important things are here, and there's plenty of embarrassing stuff in here. What he didn't think about was that by that point, some of the conversations that were reflected in those transcripts had been subpoenaed and had been actually handed over to the impeachment inquiry. And so there were members of the House who had listened to the tapes that were represented in these transcripts. And so they saw these transcripts and they went back to their notes on the tapes they'd listened to. And they were like, wait, there are major things missing here. There are entire passages where Nixon all but says, I did a crime, that aren't here. And so they leaked it. They leaked those discrepancies to the press. And Pat Buchanan, then working as a sort of speechwriter slash spokesman slash advisor to Nixon, went out to the press and said, you guys should be, you journalists should be looking at the real story, which is these leaks. You know, how can you, you know, you got to figure out who these leakers are. And so, gosh, you know, that is just, you know, it could have happened yesterday, or you could have read the same quote yesterday from Pat Buchanan, in fact. So in that case, I did sort of deliberately include, it's not an important moment in the story of Watergate, but it was kind of delightful. So
you come out of doing this series with a palpable sense of hope. And I was hoping that you might elaborate a little bit on why reporting for as long as you did on Watergate leaves you with a sense of hope today.
Well, I don't know how hopeful I am. I think insofar as it did make me hopeful to learn the details of this story, it was that it's because there were just so many people who stood up and kind of acted and took initiative in whatever ways they could, whether they were members of, you know, the Senate Watergate Committee, or whether they were just little 25-year-old lawyers who worked for the senators in the Senate Watergate Committee. There were a lot of people who did their jobs, and they, as a result, the institutions that they were part of kind of played their proper function, played their proper role. You don't play a function.
Served their proper function.
Thank you. There you go. And so that makes me hopeful. I feel like people are motivated to you know, insofar as there's wrongdoing to be uncovered, people are motivated to uncover it right now. And on the other hand, it did also feel to me, though, as though the ending of Watergate was in no way inevitable. Like it was the result of, again, many different people doing, you know, taking initiative. And if they hadn't, and if things hadn't broken a certain way, then it might have ended a very different way. In some cases, it wasn't about anyone taking initiative. It was about people making stupid decisions, like Nixon deciding to tape himself committing crimes. You know, a misfire that I think determined the course of the story as much as anything else. You know, the fact that there was a John Dean, that the guy, you know, a White House counsel who was willing to testify in the way he did, and there could have not been one, you know, and who knows how it would have turned out if there hadn't been.
Well, I just have to say, you and your colleagues have done an amazing thing with this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here.
Leon Nafok is a reporter for Slate and the voice of the Slow Burn podcast about Watergate. Nafok was born in Moscow but grew up in the Chicago area. We spoke with him in an event last week, co-sponsored by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Center for 21st Century Studies.